Everyone, I'd like to call this first conference committee of the Jobs, Labor, Energy, and Commerce Bill to order. Before we get started, I thought it'd be good just to do some quick introductions.
Your video's not working.
My video's not working?
Do you remember restart your computer?
No. Kind of do that. And so I'll just... What we'll do is we'll introduce, maybe we'll go down the Senate members and then we'll go down the House members. Eric Pratt, I represent Senate District 55. I chair the Jobs Policy and Finance Committee. Senator Rarick.
Senator Rarick, I represent District 11 and I chair the Labor Committee in the Senate.
Senator
Senjum. Senator
Rochester,
I chair the Energy and
I've been informed Senator Daines has a bill up on the Senate floor right now, and we also have Senator Frentz. We'll have him introduce himself if he attends. Chair Noor.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Good afternoon, everyone. Mahmoud Noor, I represent District 60B in Minneapolis, Chair for Workforce and Business Development. Excited to be here for the opening of our conference committee and transfer next to Chair Eklund.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Rob Eklund, I represent District 3A.
Oh, yeah, don't forget about the Senate.
Got to unmute myself, it says here, too. It'd be easier not to do this. But anyway, I represent District 3A, most of northeastern Minnesota. I chair the Labor, Industry, Veterans, and Military Affairs, Finance, and Policy Committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm Chair Zach Stevenson. I represent Coon Rapids and Champlin, and I chair the Commerce Committee in the House.
Representative Jamie Long, I chair the Climate and Energy Committee in the House.
Hi, Chris Wozinski, House District 16A, Southwest Minnesota. I farm and have a welding business.
Members, in your packets, we have some letters of testimony to look at your convenience. We do have a hard stop at 4 o'clock today, so we do need to proceed. The agenda for the day is really just to go through the bill comparison. With nonpartisan staff, anything we don't finish up today, we will... take up on Monday, as Chair Noor and I have agreed to. So with that, we'll go ahead and turn it over to the nonpartisan staff to help you with the walk. Whoever wants to start. Are we doing appropriations first?
Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I have my energy things. Are there other documents other places?
Senator Senator, your binder should have all the provisions in it. Do you have a black binder right next to you?
Thank you, sir. I thought that was Senator Frentz's.
This is mine.
All right. This is Senator Frentz.
Thank you.
So we'll go ahead and start with nonpartisan, however you guys have agreed to cover it first.
Mr. Chair, members, is there an agenda? Do we have an agenda? What order things were going in today? And was it jobs and then labor?
Order of the bill. Yeah.
Oh, order of the bill? Okay.
Energy would be first.
Energy is first in the bill.
All right.
Oh.
Then we'll cover energy first.
Okay. Do you want to go through the spreadsheet first? And then what we'll do is he'll go do the spreadsheet, and then we were going to kind of trade off between House and Senate only in
absolutely.
That fashion.
So, Mr. Chair and members, I'll start with the spreadsheet that's in your packets. The first section of it is the energy and utilities and climate and energy portion. I will just speak to the items in the Senate bill and then hand it off to the House fiscal analyst, Ashley Eng, to walk through the provisions that are in the House bill. The first item in the Senate bill is a appropriation for the Solar for Schools program. This is a $4.15 million appropriation in fiscal year 23 and a $5.7 million base amount in fiscal year 24 from the general fund for this program. This is also a provision in the House bill that is of a different amount. It's $3 million in fiscal year 23 only. The next item is on line four. It's $150,000 from the general fund for an advanced nuclear study. This is a one-time appropriation to the Department of Commerce. That was not a provision in the House. The next item in the Senate is actually on page two. There is a $2.29 million appropriation to the Granite Falls Hydropower Project. This is from the Renewable Development Account and is to cover cost overruns. This was a project that was received an appropriation, I think, a couple years ago, and the amount was not sufficient. Costs have increased, and that's why there's an appropriation here. The next appropriation is on line 77. It's a $3.5 million appropriation from the Renewable Development Account to install solar panels on the National Sports Center roof in Blaine. And then on line 79 is a $3.5 million one-time appropriation in fiscal year 23 from the Renewable Development Account for the Community Energy Transition Grants Program that is run by the Department of Employment and Economic Development. This is something that has also received appropriations in the past. And I'll point out, too, that this is a provision that's being carried in the House bill, but with a different amount and a different funding source. It's a $2 million appropriation from the general fund. The last energy items in the Senate bill are on lines 84 through 87, and these are revenue changes. The first is a $500,000 a year cancellation of an appropriation that is to the Department of Commerce for a third-party evaluator. Instead of appropriating that money on line 85, there's a change in the Senate bill that would allow Xcel Energy to simply withhold $150,000 per year for that purpose, beginning in fiscal year 23. On line 86, there is a withholding amount for the Solar for Schools program for projects within Xcel's service territory. That is an $8 million amount in fiscal year 25. And lastly, on line 87 is the solar awards withholding amount. In both the House and the Senate bills, it's being increased by $5 million each year for fiscal year 24 and 25. And then it's not shown on the spreadsheet because it's beyond the state's fiscal horizon, but there would be a $10 million amount for that purpose in fiscal year 26. The total of the energy provisions in the Senate bill are that $4.3 million general fund appropriation and $5.7 million general fund base amount for from the general fund. And then the net effect of the renewable development account changes is $8.44 million in the current biennium and $17.3 million in the planning period. And that's it for the Senate portion of the bill. I think the House, Ms. Eng will discuss the House provisions.
Thank you, Mr. Ma. Ms. Eng.
Hi, Ashley Eng, House Fiscal. I think I'll share my screen. So we'll begin on line three to items to the Department of Commerce. There is $3 million in fiscal year 23 to Solar for Schools. On line 5, there is $4 million in fiscal year 23 towards solar on public buildings. On line 6, there is $30 million in fiscal year 23 and $30 million in the TAILS to the Weatherization Assistance Program. On line 7, there is $2,195,000 in fiscal year 23 towards residential electric panel upgrades. On line 8, there is $500,000 in fiscal year 23 to the automobile dealer electric vehicle certification. On line 9, there is $10 million in fiscal year 23 towards the state competitiveness fund. On line 10, there is $5 million in fiscal year 23 towards the Energy Alley Startup Fund. On line 11, there is $500,000 in fiscal year 23 towards electric vehicle charging stations at county government centers. On line 12, there is $531,000 in fiscal year 23 towards the energy benchmarking program. On line 13, there is $109,000 in ongoing funding towards the participation in customer disputes before the PUC. On line 14, there is $35,000 in ongoing funding towards the participant compensation in customer disputes for the PUC. On line 15, there is $10 million in fiscal year 23 to the Minnesota Innovation Finance Authority. On line 16, there is $141,000 in ongoing funding towards energy storage systems. There, on line 17, there is $70,000 in ongoing funding towards electrification plan. On line 18, there is $225,000 in ongoing funding towards extraordinary event bonds. On line 19, there is $35,000 in ongoing funding towards electric school bus promotion. Looking at the PUC items, on line 22, there is $234,000 in fiscal year 23 and $456,000 in the TAILS towards consumer disputes. On line 23, there is $32,000 in ongoing funding towards the administration of participant compensation. On line 24, there is $135,000 in ongoing funding towards energy storage system proceedings. On line 25, there is $32,000 in ongoing funding for the utility transportation electrification plan. On line 26, there is $32,000 in ongoing funding towards electric school bus promotion. On line 27, there is $172,000 of ongoing funding towards the extraordinary event bonds. Looking at items towards Department of Employment and Economic Development, on line 30, there is $500,000 in fiscal year 23 towards clean energy training. On line 31, there is $2 million in fiscal year 23 towards community energy transition grants. And towards the Pollution Control Agency, there is $300,000 in fiscal year 23 towards a report on greenhouse gas reduction strategies. That is line 35. And on line 36, there is $3 million in fiscal year 23 towards grants to local governments to address climate change. To the Pollution Control Agency, and now to the Department of Natural Resources, there is $4,100,000 in fiscal year 23 towards electric vehicles charging stations in state parks. To the Department of Transportation, there is $2,100,000 in fiscal year 23 towards electric vehicle charging stations at highway rest areas. And on line 42, there is $81,000 in fiscal year 23 towards the Buy Clean Task Force. To the Department of Labor and Industry, on line 45, there is $133,000 in fiscal year 23 towards the state building code modifications to address EV buildings. On line 46, there is $146,000 to new commercial energy code implementation. To the Department of Administration, on line 49, there is $314,000 in fiscal year 23 towards the BiClean Task Force. On line 50, there is $600,000 in fiscal year 23 towards the University of Minnesota's weather trend study. Finally, to the University of Minnesota, there is $1 million in fiscal year 23 toward the weather resiliency program. Looking down at revenue, some of the provisions in this bill have assessment authority. So these items listed in lines 55 through 60 assess back the expenditures. So there is a revenue on line 61 of $1,252,000 in fiscal year 23 and $2,492,000 in the tails. Now looking at the renewable development account, starting with the Department of Commerce. On line 65, there is $5 million in fiscal year 23 and $10 million in tails for grants for renewable integration and demonstration. On line 66, there is $4 million in fiscal year 23 towards residential electric panel upgrades. On line 67, there is $3 million in fiscal year 23 towards the Ford Site Solar Contingency Fund. On line 68, there is $6,500,000 in fiscal year 23 towards the Anoka Hennepin School Geothermal Demonstration Project. On line 69, there is $531,000 in fiscal year 24 and $431,000 in fiscal year 25 towards the Energy Benchmarking Program. On line 70, there is $500,000 in fiscal year 23 towards EV charging stations at county government centers. On line 71, there is $4 million in ongoing funding for energy storage system awards. On line 72, there is $4 million in fiscal year 23 and $4 million in tails for solar on public buildings. On line 73, there is $221,000 ongoing funding towards, line 73, there is $10 million in fiscal year 23 to the State Competitiveness Fund. And on line 74, there is $221,000 in ongoing funding towards the participation in PUC proceedings for the energy storage systems. And then that was to the Department of Commerce. And then there's one item on line 82 that is to the Met Council, which is $3 million in fiscal year 23 towards EV buses. Looking down at line 87, there is a withholding in the bill of $5 million in fiscal year 24 and $5 million in fiscal 25 for a solar rewards program. And so looking at the totals by fund, this will be line 92 for the general fund, which includes the total appropriations and revenue impact. So there is $80 million in fiscal year 23 and $30 million in the tails. And for the renewable development account on line 95, there is a total of $40,221,000 in fiscal year 23 and $33,404,000 in the tails. And that concludes my presentation.
Thank you, Ms. Ng. Do you have any questions for Mr. Mumble, Ms. Ng? Representative.
Thank you, Chair Pratt. Just kind of in general, thank you, staff, for your walkthrough. How much in the Senate bill and then how much in the House bill is being returned to ratepayers?
Mr. Chair, Representative Swedinski, on the Senate side, I'm not sure how to categorize returned to ratepayers, so I'm afraid I don't have a good answer for you.
Thank you, Chair. And to Mr. Mullum? Mum? Sorry. so just particularly, how about like with the renewable fuel account or, you know, any of those other taxes that are levied on utilities, how much of those dollars are being returned to ratepayers?
Mr. Chair, Representative Swedinski, I don't think there are any provisions in the bill that are for the explicit purpose of returning money to ratepayers.
Okay, thank you.
Any other question on the energy spreadsheets? Okay. Seeing none, before we move on, I want to welcome Senator Prentz. We just did some quick introductions. If you want to introduce yourself real quick.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair, and thanks, members. I'm Senator Nick Frentz, proudly representing District 19 in southern Minnesota, which is roughly described as the Mankato area, and proud to be the ranking member on the Senate Energy and Utilities Committee, and especially proud to join all of you. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. Okay, why don't we move on to the jobs and economic growth and workforce and business development sections.
Well, Mr. Chair, it's up to you, but if you want to keep doing, if you want to do the entire spreadsheet section by section and then do the policy articles section by section, we can do it. Okay. So I will also try to share my screen. I have not done that in a while. So for the Senate side of the jobs and economic growth the jobs and economic growth portion of the bill, there is just one appropriation, and it is on line 167 of the spreadsheet. I'm sorry, that's... All right. It is actually, I'm sorry, on line 189 of the spreadsheet. There is a $50,000 appropriation in fiscal year 23 for the Abijah's on the backside, a grant to the Abijah's on the backside program. On line 174, there is a $175,000 appropriation from the general fund for an evaluation of the adequacy of benefits that police, firefighters, and state troopers receive. This is also a provision without the funding is not contained in the pensions bill, but the instruction to complete this, the evaluation is also in that bill. And then lastly, on line 190, there is a $25,000 appropriation for the Youth Skills Training Program. This would be a one-time appropriation in fiscal year 23. That is also a provision that is in the House. But of a different amount, the House bill appropriates $500,000 above the base amount for the Youth Skills Training Program and $247,000 for administration, and that would be ongoing funding. The amount slightly increase in the tails for the administration component of that program. I apologize, Mr. Chair. I kind of jumped around there, but that's the Senate jobs and labor portion of the spreadsheet.
Thank you, Mr. Mom. And who's going to be covering this from the House? Is in the Senate? Oh, Ms. Roberts, welcome to the committee.
Mr. Chair and members, I'm Helen Roberts from the House Fiscal Staff, and I will share the same spreadsheet and walk through the House portion of the labor and industry portion of the bill. So starting with the Department of Labor and Industry, the total increase for DLI is $7.1 million, and that includes some of the appropriations for earned sick and safe time, which are at the come later in the spreadsheet. But starting on line 175 for the Labor Standards and Apprenticeship Program, The first item is 1.059 million from the Workforce Development Fund for labor, education, and advancement program, or LEAP grants. On line 178, there's $316,000 from the Workforce Development Fund for the Apprenticeship Program Administration. On line 179, 1.758 million from the Workforce Fund for prevailing wage education and compliance. On line 180 is $196,000 from the general fund to expand and strengthen the fair labor standards for agriculture and food processing workers. On line 181, $500,000 one-time additional funding for the logger safety program, so the program that was established in the 2021 session. On line 182, there is $200,000 for a veterans liaison coordinator. And on line 183, $300,000 one time for statewide apprenticeship readiness program. And then line 187 is the total for the labor standards and apprenticeship program of 4.3 million, of which 1.2 million is from the general fund and 3.1 million from the workforce development fund. Moving on to the workforce development initiatives, which are $747,000 total. On line 190, there's $500,000 for the youth skills training program, as Mr. Munn mentioned. And then line 191, $247,000 for the administration of that program. Moving down to combative sports. On line 197, there's $150,000 from the general fund for health and safety improvements. And then going down to the construction codes program, $2.85 million is from the general fund for a transfer to the construction codes fund. And this transfer is intended to partially backfill the fund for the revenue loss from a building and trade fee holiday in the House bill. On line 201, there is $255,000 from the general fund for an ombudsperson for agricultural and food processing workers. On line 202, $252,000 for an agricultural worker wellness committee. And then on line 205, $82,000 from the workers' compensation fund for enforcement of warehouse distribution worker safety. On line 207, there's a $145,000 increase in the statutory appropriation from the construction codes fund for new commercial code energy code implementation. On line 208, $160,000 from the construction codes fund related to safe housing for elderly and vulnerable adults. And then on line 209, $14,000 from the special revenue fund for health and safety improvement for the combative sports. At the bottom of this page, you can see the funding for the Workers' Compensation Court of Appeals. There are two change items. On line 211, $100,000 in one-time funding for rulemaking related to campus, and then $200,000 for an operating adjustment. On the next page, you'll see the Bureau of Mediation Services. There's a $400,000 increase in fiscal year 23, and then $1,050,000 in the tails for the Public Employee Relations Board. The next few lines show the appropriations for the earned sick and safe time provisions, lines 217 to 223, and those total $1.74 million, and that includes $1.4 million to DLI for enforcement and $300,000 for grants to community organizations. Then you can see there are some revenue changes on lines 225 to 227 related to prevailing wage education and compliance, the OSHA federal penalty conformity, and then you'll see the line item on 227 for the building and trade fee holiday. And then finally, the totals by fund for the labor and industry portion of the bill. On line 231, the net general fund impact is $7.574 million. On line 234, $262,000 net total from the workers' compensation fund. On line 235, $3.1 million from the workforce development fund. And then on line 239, $812,000 net impact to the construction codes fund. And that completes the House provisions.
Thank you. Do we have any questions regarding this section of the spreadsheet? Okay. Seeing none, why don't we go ahead and move over to the commerce and...
We'll put the job section. We'll skip to the labor, Mr. Chair.
Oh. Okay. I thought we covered the whole thing.
No.
All right. Is that Ms. Reynolds again?
Ms.
Ng. Ms. Ng. Okay.
Are we doing workforce now?
Yes, Ms. Ng, we're doing the workforce section.
Thank you. I'll share again. So this will be on page 3, I believe, of the spreadsheet. Yep. And we'll begin with the business and community development appropriations to deed. So starting on line 98, there is $20 million in fiscal year 23 towards the Main Street Economic Revitalization Program. On line 99, there is $45 million in fiscal year 23 and $6 million in the tails towards the Spark Business Loan Program. On line 102, there is $20 million in fiscal year 23 and $2 million in the tails towards the Emerging Developer Program. On line 103, there is $7,500,000 in fiscal year 23 towards Canadian Border County's Economic Relief Program. On line 105, there is $35 million in fiscal year 23 towards the Small Business Recovery Grant Program. On line 106, there is $800,000 in fiscal year 23 towards Enterprise Minnesota. On line 107, there is $1 million in fiscal year 23 and $1 million in the tails towards the Minnesota marketing campaign. On line 108, there is $2 million in fiscal year 23 towards the Center for Economic Inclusion. On line 109, there is $1 million in fiscal year 23 towards the Coalition of Asian American Leaders. On line 110, there is $2 million in fiscal year 23 towards the Women's Foundation of Minnesota. Now looking at the business and community development, these are amendments to current law. So looking at line 113, there is $5 million additional funding in fiscal year 23 and $7 million in sales towards the Business Development Competitive Grant Program. And on line 115, there is $4 million additional funding towards the child care business startups. And on line 116, there is $5 million additional and $2,500,000 additional in details towards the redevelopment program. Looking down at the Employment and Training Programs Division of DEED, on line 119, there is $1 million in fiscal year 23 towards the Office of New Americans. On line 124, there is $750,000 in fiscal year 23 from the Workforce Development Fund towards Teamworks. On line 125, there is $20 million in fiscal year 23 from the Workforce Development Fund for the Workforce Development Boards. On line 126, there is $5 million in fiscal year 23 from the Workforce Development Fund for the Youth Technology Competitive Grant Program. On line 127, there is $470,000 in fiscal year 23 and $1 million in the tails towards the Office of New Americans. And on line 128, there is $25,230,000 in fiscal year 23 towards the Targeted Community Capital Program. Looking down at line 134, there is a cancellation that is appropriated of $889,000 in fiscal year 23 towards Targeted Community Capital Program. And on line 136, this is a policy change that allows access to federal funds of $3 million in fiscal year 25. And on line 138, there is $161 million $743,000 in fiscal year 23 towards the school reimbursement account for unemployment insurance benefits. Looking down at paid family and medical leave appropriations, looking at the total on line 152, there is $31,986,000 in fiscal year 23, mainly to DEED for the startup of the program, then $8,691,000 in the TAILS for ongoing. Then on line 153, there is $523,486,000 in the TAILS from the paid family medical leave account. So that is appropriations. Now looking at the revenue, there is revenue from the paid family leave account to the general fund in fiscal year 24. And that is a transfer reflected on line 156. And then additional revenue to the general fund from that account, making a revenue total on line 159 of $32,676,000 in the TAILS. So looking at totals by fund, we have the general fund, net impact, which includes the appropriations and the revenue impacts, on line 166 of $368,729,000 in the current biennium, and a positive $4,485,000 in the TAILS. Looking at the Workforce Development Fund total, on line 167, there is $28,883,000 in the current biennium, which includes the labor appropriations, and $6,266,000 in the TAILS. And that concludes the workforce.
Thank you, Ms. Ng. So now I'll take questions on the workforce and jobs and labor sections of the spreadsheet. Senator Senjum.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Could, with some level of briefness, somebody describe how the Workforce Development Fund is funded? Is that a general fund appropriation to do a specific fund? I just don't remember.
Senator Senjum, it's a surcharge onto the unemployment insurance premium.
Thank you.
Any other questions? Senator, or Representative Swazinski.
Thank you, Chair Pratt. And just a question. So when the account was backfilled because of the previous bill that we just passed 2 weeks ago, how does the Workforce Development Fund, is it the state then just reimbursed that section when we spent those dollars?
Mom, was there a reimbursement back to the Workforce Development Fund?
Mr. Chair, Representative Swedinski, no, that is a separate tax from the unemployment insurance tax, and so there's no effect of the bill that was enacted a couple weeks ago on the Workforce Development Fund.
Representative Knorr.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I think to clarify, I think if people have been assessed, because this is not the UI tax, the additional Workforce Development Fund, so in addition to what they've already paid during the recalculation so that they can get a credit or a refund, that will be factored in as far as I understand because it's on top of what they've been paying. So my assumption is if you paid more into that account, you'll be refunded or you'll get a credit into the future. I think the department can clarify that, but that's the assumption based on the rates that we changed, making sure that the rates remain low. And the good news is the state of Minnesota as of today has got a zero balance outstanding. So for the good work that we all collectively did.
So I think just to clarify, there was no direct appropriation into the Workforce Development Fund. All monies that were appropriated in the UI fund went to the reserve to pay claims. Any other questions? Okay, seeing none. The last spreadsheet is the commerce section.
Mr. Mum, did you want to talk about the Commerce section?
Mr. Chair, no, there are no appropriations on the Senate side here, so I think Ms. Eng can go through the House portion.
Thank you. Ms. Eng.
Yeah. Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. I'll share again, and this will be on page 7. Starting with the Administrative Services Division of the Department of Commerce, line 242, there is $301,000 ongoing funding to the Senior Fraud Prevention Program. Looking at Financial Services Division, on line 244, there is $300,000 in fiscal year 23 and $562,000 in the tails towards additional security staff. On line 245, there is $233,000 in fiscal year 23 and $406,000 in the tails towards a student loan advocate. In the insurance division, there is $108,000 in fiscal year 23 towards the health insurance geographic area study. That's on line 248. On line 249, there is $525,000 of ongoing funding towards additional insurance staff. In the enforcement division, there is on line 252, there's $4,076,000 in fiscal year 23 to the Automobile Theft Prevention Program. And on line 253, there is $500,000 in fiscal year 23 from that account, the Automobile Theft Prevention account, to investigation and enforcement. Looking at the Fraud Bureau Division, there is a transfer from the general fund to the Insurance Fraud Prevention account on line 256 of $870,000 in fiscal year 23 and $1,622,000 in the tails. And that is for 5 additional peace officers reflected there on line 257. On line 259, there is an expense of $783,000 in fiscal year 23 and $1,566,000 in the tails for the financial institutions assessment equity. This is an item that changes the deposits of revenue of assessment from the general fund to the special revenue fund. So it's expensed here, but there's also a line reflecting the revenue change in the general fund below. So line 261 through 267 covers the appropriations of the preliminary licensing applications. So a total for the general fund of this provision on line 269 is $276,000 in fiscal year 23 and $564,000 in the tails for the general fund. And then on line 270, that is the lawful gambling regulation account. That is to the gambling control board of $3,000 in fiscal year 23 and $6,000 in the tails. And looking down, there is an anticipated revenue on line for the preliminary licensing on line 273, $57,000 in fiscal year 23 and $114,000 in the tails. So then looking down at the total of appropriations and then revenue, the general fund net impact on line 281 is $7,815,000 in fiscal year 23 and $6,258,000 in the tails. And that concludes my presentation.
Thank you, Ms. Eng. Do we have any questions regarding the financial review on the Commerce section? Okay. Seeing none, I think that closes up the spreadsheets. Mr. Mum.
Mr. Chair, I just wanted to point out one other item on the spreadsheet. It's on line 289. This is the $250 million for frontline worker bonuses that is technically in the Senate bill because it was passed prior to the enactment of the UI trust fund replenishment. So that's why it's on here.
Representative Knorr.
Mr. Chair, I just wanted to confirm with Mr. Mum, is that available, resources for this committee to look into? Is it not spent?
I can answer that. That has been
those funds are not available to the committee on the Senate side. They have been spent in the unemployment bill.
All right.
All right. Mr. LaFontaine, do you want to start with the bill walkthrough?
Mr. Chair, members, I think, so if we want to go in the same order of the spreadsheets, we'll start with the energy articles. And so if you want to pull up those or get those side by sides, and I'll have Mr. Eloff start. And the language, the policy language starts on page R15 of the energy side-by-side document. It's about 115-page document.
Thank you. And I'm sorry, who from the House was going to?
Bob Eloff.
Okay, welcome to the committee, Mr. Eloff. Feel free to begin when you're ready.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm working off the side-by-side that's entitled Energy Finance and Policy, and as Doyle Fontaine mentioned, we'll be starting on page R15 with Article 19, which is entitled Energy Conservation. The first three sections in this article deal with the state weatherization program. Section 1 establishes an account where state supplementary weatherization appropriations can be deposited. Section 2 on page R15 expands the types of activities that those funds can be spent on to include installation of pre-weatherization measures. Always happens. Increasing the number of weatherized residences and conducting outreach activities. On page R16, section 3 establishes a weatherization training grant program in the Department of Commerce to make sure that there are sufficient workers trained to conduct weatherization activities. On page R17 is section 4, energy benchmarking, this extends to page R22. This requires owners of certain buildings over 50,000 square feet to use a software program developed by the U.S. Department of Energy to report their annual energy use to the Commerce Department each year. And on page R23, near the bottom, the continuation of section 5 is a section that allows municipalities to adopt the most recently published new model commercial energy code before the Department of Labor and Industry does it, but after the federal Department of Energy has determined that the newest code is an improvement over the old code. At the bottom of page R23 is Article 20, entitled Commission Proceedings. The first two sections in this article relate to a new process for resolving consumer disputes between utility customers and utilities themselves, and provides that the dispute which is not settled can be taken before the commission itself for a final decision. On page R26, section 3 in the middle of the page, requires utilities to identify in their integrated resource plans for non-renewable energy facilities that are going to be ceasing operations within 15 years, what kinds of transmission facilities may be needed in terms of upgrading to deal with the retirement of those facilities. Beginning with section 4 on page 26 and extending to page R41 is an article that deals with securitization, which allows for, in the event of extraordinary events such as storms that destroy or utility infrastructure, or extreme increases in wholesale prices, such as we experienced last year with the natural gas vortex. It allows cost revenues for those to repay those incidents to be raised through the issuance of corporate bonds rather than traditional energy utility financing, which will save money in terms of the interest rates for those bonds. That continues to page R41. And in the middle of page R41 is language that is the same for both the House and the Senate. I'm referring to section 13, which raises the minimum amount from $100,000 to $1 million for the sale of utility assets that must be brought before the Public Utilities Commission for approval. At the bottom of page R41 is a section that revises the process to compensate participants in Public Utilities Commission's proceedings. It describes what are the conditions under which those participants can be compensated and the amount of compensation to be awarded. That extends to page R46, where in the middle of the page is section 15, which provides that with respect to the siting of electric generating facilities, the Commissioner of Commerce may take action on projects where the Commission has made a final decision, but before a written order has been issued by the Commission. And at the bottom of page R46 and extending onto the top of page 47 is section 16. The only change there is made on line 236.2, which expands from 5 to 30 miles the size of a high-voltage transmission line that would be subject to the alternate site review process by the Public Utilities Commissions. The benefits of that being that only one site or route must be presented to the Commission rather than two separate ones. And the repealer at the in the middle of the page in section 17 of R47 repeals the existing intervener compensation language. Article 21, titled Energy Storage, begins on the bottom of page R47, and section 1 establishes that for the purposes of interconnecting a solar system that is also operating in tandem with an energy storage system, the system capacity must be calculated as the capacity of the solar energy storage system alone. Turning now to page R48 at the top, section 2 requires the Public Utilities Commission to initiate a docket by September to determine how much compensation should be paid to owners of on-site energy storage systems to compensate them or the benefits they're providing to utilities by discharging energy during periods of peak demand. In the middle of that page, section 4 requires utilities that are operating under multi-year rate plans to include in their distribution plans how the deployment of energy storage can support the continued development of renewable resources. And at the bottom of that page is section 5, which establishes a new storage rewards incentive program modeled on the solar rewards program, which would provide grants to owners that install storage systems on their properties. Towards the bottom of page R49 is Article 22, titled Renewable Energy. And the first section there refers to state buildings, which says that if all cost-effective energy conservation measures have been included in new construction for state buildings, and the required Sustainable Building 2030 energy standards have not been met, that solar must begin to be used to help meet those standards. And on page R50, section 2 also refers to state buildings that install solar, and it limits the solar capacity that can be installed. At the bottom of page R50 is the part of the statutes dealing with the solar rewards program, and that extends onto page 51. This language extends or increases the payments to $10 million in both fiscal 23 and 24, as you can see on page R51, and extends the program for an additional year in 2025 to $10 million. The Senate and House language is identical except in two respects. On line 7-7 of the Senate language and 241.5 of the House language, There are two different years for when unspent monies in the account must be transferred back to the RDA, Senate being 2026, House being 2027. And at the very bottom of page R51, there is additional language in the House version that requires contractors and subcontractors installing a solar system award financial assistance with solar rewards to pay at least the state prevailing wage rate. At the top of page R52 is actually an appropriation rider, which indicates the withholding by Xcel Energy of that of the money that's going to the solar rewards program. The next section on page R52 is the solar energy contingency account. This concerns a development that's occurring in St. Paul, a new residential development on the site of the old Ford plant. The issue is that the site where a solar array is expected to be installed may be contain contamination from that Ford plant, which the Pollution Control Agency is investigating. And this language appropriates $3 million to be used as a contingency fund in case the solar array is put up, and after that, the Pollution Control Agency decides that the contamination must be removed, in which case the solar array needs to be removed. It's the contingency fund is to pay the developer and installer of the solar array for those additional costs. And at the very bottom of page R53 is some Senate-only language that Ms. Doyle Fontaine will summarize.
Thank you, Mr. Yaw. And thank you. So on the bottom of page 53, we come finally to a Senate provision. This provision would require for any proposed wind or solar electric generating facility that has a capacity of 50 megawatts or more would need to, in addition to any other approvals, would need to obtain approval from the governing board of the county in which the proposed wind or solar facility would be located. And then we go back to House language.
Back to House only language on page R54. Section 5 makes amendments to the Community Solar Garden Statute. Three of them are on that first page, R54. It increases from the maximum capacity of a solar garden from 1 to 3 megawatts. Right now, there's a requirement that the subscribers to a solar garden reside in either the same or a contiguous county to where the generation facility is located. This language would remove that requirement, provided that the solar garden has a minimum setback of 100 feet from the nearest residential property. And finally, at the very bottom of the page, it provides that the rate at which energy generated by the solar garden is purchased by the utility will be the most recent three-year average of the rate cap of the value of solar rate, essentially. Additional changes to the community solar garden statute are on the next couple of pages, the main one being on page R57, the development of what's called a community access project, which requires that 50% or more of the capacity of the solar garden be subscribed by residential subscribers. And if that is the case, the compensation for generation for those community access gardens is the retail rate of solar. On page R58 is section 6, which says that a certificate of need is not needed from the Public Utilities Commission for solar or wind projects where the commission in the most recent integrated resource plan of the utility that will purchase that energy authorized the purchase of enough of the same capacity that the solar or wind project would provide for. At the very bottom of page R59, section 7, the change is at the top. This expands the Solar on Schools program to specifically include a tribal contract school. And then there is another Senate-only provision on page R60.
Yes, on page R60, on the Senate language, this is the statute that directs the Xcel Energy to run a solar for schools program. And this would require Xcel to withhold $8 million in 2024 for their solar on schools program.
At the bottom of page R60 is Section 8 in the House language, which establishes a new grant program for the installation of solar energy on public buildings for local units of government. And on page R63, Section 9 in the middle of the page, is a change to the definition of solar energy generating system to include transmission lines which are operating at 100 kilovolts or less that interconnect to high voltage transmission lines. This is a definition that's used when the PUC is issuing siting permits. Section 10 at the bottom of page R63 states that in an environmental impact statement on a solar facility, only one site is needed to be presented rather than more. And on the top of page R64 is another Senate-only provision, Mr. Chair.
Yes, on the top of R64, there's a provision that would ban political subdivisions from prohibiting certain types of energy systems from being connected to buildings. So this would prohibit the local government from enacting this type of ban.
Thank you. Before we move on, Representative Swedzinski, you had a question?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just going back to that program funding on R60, the Senate version, it talks that the utility must withhold the $8 million. Is that so the money doesn't pass through to the state to refill the RDA? Or is that what is being withheld there? Where is it from?
Mr. Chair and Representative, so for when Xcel runs programs, right now the renewable development money comes to the state, but it would come from Xcel from the ratepayers. So they would just withhold that money from coming to the state, and then they would run the program through that withheld money. That's the mechanism for funding programs that Xcel that runs on their own.
Sounds good. Thank you.
Thank you. Any other questions before we move on? Okay, seeing none. Mr. Elf.
Back to page R64, the House language, Section 11. Provides limits on how homeowners associations can restrict the use of solar energy systems. And on page R66, Section 12, requires investor-owned utilities by this coming October to submit a plan to the Public Utilities Commission for a demand credit rider that essentially issues a rebate that reflects the value of solar that solar energy has in helping utilities meet their capacity needs. And Section 13, the sections repealed are the two sections I mentioned at the beginning regarding solar on state buildings. Okay, Article 23, towards the bottom of the page, is electric vehicles. And Section 1 establishes a hierarchy of vehicles for the state vehicle fleet, where electric vehicles are the first choice, provided that they can provide the services that are needed. Section 2 on page R67 says that purchases by individual departments of vehicles must abide by that same hierarchy that's established in Section 1. Section 3 at the bottom of page R67 allows electric vehicle charging stations to be established in safety rest areas on roads in Minnesota. And on page R68 in the middle of the page, section 4 requires motor vehicle dealers in Minnesota that must have at least one employee who has been trained under a training program run by a motor vehicle dealership in Minnesota regarding the sale of electric vehicles. At the top of page R69 is a language that requires public utilities to file with the Public Utilities Commission a plan for the expanded deployment of electric vehicles. That extends to page R72, where section 6 says the public utilities may file with the commission a program to promote the deployment of electric school buses. At the bottom of page R73, section 7, is a program which awards grants to automobile dealers in Minnesota to help them with the certification process that is required if they are to sell electric vehicles from the manufacturers of those vehicles. It's a grant program that allows up to $40,000 for grants for those purposes. On page R74 and top of R75 are several definitions which deal with requiring the energy code to require minimum numbers of what's called electric vehicle ready spaces to be established in new commercial and multifamily structures. Section 13 in the middle of page R75 is a program that provides funding for electric vehicle charging stations to be installed in state and regional parks. And on page R76, section 14 establishes the same kind of program for installations at county government centers. Which brings us to page R77, Article 24, Renewable Leak Atomic Development. The change in this very long section is actually on the bottom of page 81. And what it says is any construction projects funded from an appropriation made through the renewable development account must pay state prevailing wage and abide by other related statutes. And that also brings us to another Senate-only language on page R81.
Ms. Doyle Fontaine.
Yes, on page R81, there are two sections, section 3 and 4 of the Senate side, that are actually for the Community Energy Transition Grant Program administered by DEED. The first section would expand eligible community to include a community that has one of the electric plant generating plants whose current operating license expires within 15 years of the effective date. And then the next section, which is the same as the on the House and Senate side, would eliminate that the grants have to be awarded through a competitive grant process. And then it also limits the grants that they cannot be awarded to an eligible community that can't be more than $500,000 in any calendar year. And then it allows the Commissioner of Deed to accept grants on an ongoing or rolling basis.
Thank you, Ms. Doyle Fontaine. Back to the House sections.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. On the bottom of page R81 is section 3, and this and the next six sections deal with the issue of maximizing local employment for construction that's approved by the PUC in various energy infrastructure projects, and also providing cost recovery to utilities resulting from the employment of local labor. And that extends to page R84. R85, which concerns the property assessed clean energy program for commercial buildings. And that has some same and some different language. So I'd like to bring Ms. Doyle Fontaine back to help explain this.
Thank you, Mr. Eloff. Mr. Chair, members. As Mr. Eliff mentioned, this is would expand the commercial PACE program to allow certain land and water improvements to be allowed in the PACE program. And it would allow those land and water improvements to be done to farmland, which is defined in both the Senate and House sides. The House language does flesh it out a little bit more as to what farmland means. It also includes some definitions about resiliency and exactly what the land and water improvements would be. But the concept is the same really in both sides, and that continues on to page R86 for that commercial ag PACE program.
Thank you.
And at the very bottom of page R86 is section 12, which establishes the Minnesota Innovation Finance Authority, which is a nonprofit corporation that is to assist in financing clean energy and other types of projects. The appropriation is a one-time infusion of startup funds. That language continues to page R92. And towards the bottom of the page, section 13, is an Energy Alley Startup Fund, which provides grants and loans to Minnesota businesses that are developing emergency energy technologies and decarbonization technologies. That language extends to page R95, where we have section 14, which are grants for renewable integration and demonstration that are to essentially modernize the grid. And that language extends to page R97, section 15, and the actual language changes are at the top of page R98. This is a section of law that provides guidance to the Public Utilities Commission in designing sites and routes for large electric generating plants. And as you can see at the top of page R98, it adds things that additional considerations that the commission is to take into account when making those decisions, evaluating enhanced environmental quality, socioeconomic impacts, and impacts on employment and other economic impacts. The bottom of page R98 is section 16, which also concerns the Public Utilities Commission's siting authority. And the new language at the top of page 95 says that no site permits can be issued unless the contractors constructing new facilities are paid no less than prevailing wage. And that same provision is in section 17 on page R99, and that applies to wind projects with a capacity of 25 megawatts or more. On R100 at the top is Article 25, greenhouse gas emissions. The first article specifies a federal document that the commission is supposed to use in estimating environmental costs when it takes those into consideration in making decisions about future energy generating facilities. On page R101 is the BiClean Task Force, which is established both by the Commissioner's Administration and Transportation. This is a task force that will examine the use for specific kinds of construction materials, such as steel, cement, and asphalt, whether vendors should be required to submit what are called environmental product declarations describing the amount of energy and environmental impacts that the manufacturer of those products used. And the task force is supposed to look at that and also decide or look at the issue of whether the commissioner should establish various greenhouse gas emission levels for those products as well. At the bottom of page R102 is section 3, which provides grants to political subdivisions that establish that provide grants to organizations in political subdivisions to deal with local climate issues. Grants can be up to $50,000. On the top of page R104 is Article 26 in the House language, this section might look familiar. Again, it's the redevelopment, renewable development account. And this, there are some differences here, which Ms. Doyle Fontaine can help us find out.
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chair and members. I'm going to go back quickly to page R100 and 101.
Right. There, I missed that.
That's okay. There, section 22 on the Senate side would establish a state policy for carbon capture and sequestration. This would states that it would be the policy of the state to support technologies that demonstrate at least 80% capability of carbon capture as a method of reducing greenhouse gases in the state. Then moving on to page R104, this is the renewable development account statute that Mr. Eloff mentioned. What on the Senate side, what's taking place or what is trying to be accomplished is to add some language that would allow the advisory group that would make grants from the renewable development account funds to function. And this would allow the Xcel, the public utility that's subject to this section, to choose the advisory group members. And then it also discusses on the bottom of page R106 the third-party expert that might be used to advise on the grants or other activities of the advisory group, that $150,000 can be withheld for those services. And then it just makes some other technical changes that are necessary for that were probably intended initially when the changes were made in the last few years to the renewable development fund, which is now the account statute. And that's what the Senate language is trying to accomplish.
And the House language is dealing with diversity issues. At the top of page R107, it indicates that in making decisions, in evaluating grant projects, the Renewable Development Account Advisory Council should also take into account the proposer's commitment to increasing the diversity of the proposer's workforce. And on top of page 108, requires that projects receiving grants submit an annual report on diversity in its workforce.
Mr. Chair, members.
The Senate language.
Yes, on the bottom of page R108, we have a couple of Senate sections. The first section, section 5, this would change some dates for the cold weather rule, the disconnects information that would need to be provided. So it just changes a couple of reporting dates or the time periods. And then on the bottom of R108, section 7, this provision would abolish the prohibition on the Public Utilities Commission from issuing a new certificate of need for new nuclear power plants, for construction of new nuclear power plants. And then we go back on R109 to some House-only language.
Section 2 establishes the Minnesota State Competitive Fund, which provides monies for matching federal funds awarded to the state for energy projects, and also to increase Minnesota's ability to successfully compete for federal funds. On page R111, at the top is Section 3. This is a new program to assist single-family residences and multifamily buildings to replace and upgrade their electrical panels to allow for the use of more electrical appliances. That extends to the top of page 114, where Section 4 expands requirements for reporting on diversity and applies them to each utility in the state, which is required to file a report annually on that subject. And there's some new Senate language on page R115.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members. On R115, again, Section 23, this would change a date for the annual report on telecommunications access from Commissioner of Commerce. And then there's another Senate-only provision, Section 27, on the bottom of R115. This would require the Commissioner of Commerce to conduct an advanced nuclear study. And Mr. Mum mentioned the funding for that, which I believe is $150,000. I can continue. There's same language on, there is a House provision that if Mr. Eloff wants to go back to that in a minute, but on page R116, section 28, this is the same language on both sides. This would require Xcel to file a plan with the Public Utilities Commission, just stating intent regarding decommissioning and demolition plan for the Allen King plant that's scheduled to retire in 2028. Then on the bottom of 116 and continuing on, there is a Tribal Advocacy Council on Energy that would require or not require Department of Commerce support. The Senate version would allow the Department of Commerce to do that, and the House version would just be permissive. They could support them, but the House version would require the Department of Commerce to support the functions or the work of the Tribal Council on Energy. And I can finish the repealer for the Senate is the repeal of the sunset on the recovery of gas utility infrastructure costs. That's the end of the Senate only language. There are a couple things for Mr. Eloff to finish up.
Mr. Eloff.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Back to page 115, section 5, towards the bottom of the page is a strictly technical amendment that corrects terminology that's used in chapter 216E. And the repealer in the House on page R118 repeals the law that allowed Xcel Energy essentially to establish a natural gas electric plant on the site of its Sherco coal plant without the necessity of going through the certificate of need process at the public utilities or getting a site permit for that plant. That concludes the House, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. Are there any questions on the energy portions of the bill? Did I hear? Okay, seeing none. Why don't we start on the next section? We will be taking a break at some point to allow House members to check in at the call. We'll take maybe a 10-minute break to do that and then come back. And as I said, we do have a hard stop at 4 o'clock. So,
Mr. Chair, shall I suggest that we do the labor? It's a small section.
Okay, why don't we go ahead and do the labor section next?
Chair and members, Anna Schleen, House Research. I'll be switching off with Ms. Doyle Fontaine. On page R1 of the side-by-side, House sections, starting on page R1, House sections 1, 2, 4 through 6, and 8 through 9. These are House-only provisions that together create a separate division of apprenticeship. Also on page R1, House Section 3, this is a House-only provision that adds a section to those that commission.
Senator Senjum.
So I think both Senator French and I can catch up. There is a lot of tabs here. Which one do I go to?
Labor appropriations.
All right, we'll take it at a Southern Minnesota speed for you.
Mr. Chair.
Chair and members, we are on the labor and industry policy and technical side-by-side. And we are on page R1, House Section 3. This is House-only language that adds a section to those the commissioner can issue a compliance order for. Turning to page R3, House Section 7. This is a House-only provision that modifies Labor Education Advancement Grant Program to focus on listed groups. Also on page R3, Section 10, that's the House section, is House-only language that prohibits non-compete agreements unless an exception applies. Turning to page R5, House Section 11. This is House-only language that prohibits restrictive franchise agreements and requires amendment of existing restrictive franchise agreements. Turning to page R6, House Section 12. This is House-only language that removes all contractor license fees for fiscal years 2023 and 2024 with one temporary exception. Turn to page R7, House Section 13. This is House-only language that designates assisted living facilities as state-licensed facilities where the Department of Labor and Industry directly administers the state building code. On page R7, House Section 14, this is House-only language that directs the commissioner to adopt each new published edition of the Model Commercial Energy Code and amend it to achieve a minimum of 8% additional efficiency. Turn to page R8. Senate Section 1 and House Section 15 are similar language that modify the state building code requirements for window cleaning safety. The Senate incorporates a national standard into the code by reference, whereas the House has the commissioner use expedited rulemaking to insert a similar national standard into the code. Turn to page R10, House Section 16. This is House-only language that raises the threshold for when municipal reports on construction and development-related fees are required. Turn to page R11, Senate Section 2 and House Section 17. These are similar language that reduce the building permit fees retroactively. The House language, the reduction fees, expires October 1st, 2023. Turning to page R12, House Section 18. This is House-only language that requires DLI to establish a cost per square foot valuation for residences for use in setting municipal building permit fees. Page R12, Senate Sections 3 through 5 and House Sections 19 through 21. These are similar language that allows work to be performed on conveyors, platform lifts other than those carrying mobility-impaired people, and dock levelers without being a licensed elevator contractor. There are very tiny technological differences. Staff recommends Senate language. Page R13, Senate Section 6, House Section 22. These are different provisions on the same topic that exempts load control equipment from the inspection requirement. The House language places a number of additional restrictions on this exemption, whereas the Senate contains additional requirements for the exempted work in Senate Section 7, which Ms. Doyle-Fontaine will cover.
Ms. Doyle-Fontaine.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members. As Mr. Shaleen mentioned, that the provision on the the middle of R14, it is similar to the exemption in the House language in that it needs to be done by a Class A electrical contractor. It doesn't have any date when the exemption would expire, whereas the House does, and the House applies only to municipals and co-ops. The Senate doesn't contain that limitation, and I'm assuming that conversation will continue about this exemption for load control work from electrical inspections. Then the Senate on Sections 8 to 12 on R14, these are several provisions that would exempt certain work from being licensed, and this work is for backflow prevention work. It's limited to systems used to apply water to soil and plant materials or provide water to landscape features. But this would also, in order to obtain the exemption, you would have to have some training as prescribed by the plumbing board. On page R18, this is the same for both the House and Senate, and this clarifies Advisory Council bill, including the presumption that was put back in place for the PTSD presumption for frontline workers. This just clarifies the effective dates for that bill that was passed by the legislature early on in session, and is the same for both. And that is the labor policy articles.
Thank you, Ms. Doyle-Fontaine. Are there any questions on labor policy? Okay, seeing none. Did you want to recess now?
Yep. Thank you, Mr. Chair. I would like to recess so we can go and answer the roll call.
Okay. This committee will stand in recess to the call of the chair, and we'll expect it to maybe take no more than 10 minutes?
Yep.
All right. We'll stand in recess. Thank you. All right, I'd like to call the conference committee back to order. And we have Ms. Doyle-Fontaine. Okay.
Why don't we go ahead and, are we on the economic development? Whoops. Are we on the economic development section next?
Yeah.
Okay, why don't we go ahead and have Ms. Shalene start on the economic development policy.
Chair and members, in the economic development policy side-by-side, turning to page R1, House Section 1, this is House-only language that requires an annual report from deed on legally mandated reports that no longer serve a useful purpose. To Ms. Doyle Fontaine.
She's not here right now. Why don't we continue on?
I can continue presenting. Yep. So R1 is Senate Section 1. This is Senate-only language that prioritizes high-wage, high-demand job training grants. Also on page R1, Senate House Section 2. This is House-only language that creates the Office of New Americans to assist with the workforce integration of immigrants and refugees. Turning to page R4, Senate Section 2. This is Senate-only language that modifies eligible expenditures for funds appropriated from the Community Energy Transition Grants Program. On page R4, Senate Section 3, House Section 3, this is the same language that allows federally recognized tribes to participate in the contamination cleanup program. Also on page R4, Senate Sections 4 through 6 and House Section 4, these are different provisions on the same subject that modify the pay-for-performance job training grant program to allow support services, limit repeat incentives for the same participant, and require provisions of records on request. The House language also restricts the incentives, or restructures the incentives into tiers of awards depending on the hours and pay rate of the job placement, limits the types of employment that qualify for incentives, and makes additional technical changes. On page R7, House Section 5, this is House-only language, that amends the Main Street Economic Revitalization Program to add a capitalized loan option and allow the commissioner to waive the matching fund requirement for projects in low-income areas. On page R12, House Section 6, this is House-only language that creates the Spark Small Business Loan Program to make loans statewide to small businesses through CDFIs. Turning to page R15, House Section 7, this is House-only language that allows DEED to make equity investments in early-stage and venture capital funds for small and emerging businesses. Also on page R15, House Section 8, this is House-only language that increases the maximum grant amount for the Targeted Community Capital Project grant program. Also on page R15, House Section 9, House-only language that creates the Emerging Developer Fund program to make loans to developers from targeted groups for projects intended to reduce racial and socioeconomic disparities. Turning to page R18, Senate Section 7 and House Section 10. These are the same language and define federal loan funds from the Department of Treasury as not being business subsidies. Turning to page R20, Senate Section 8, House Section 11, these are similar language that alters the language describing partners in the Pathways Program. The Senate language encompasses private businesses, tribal-owned businesses, and municipal and county hospitals. House language only mentions participating businesses. Turning to page R21, Senate Section 9, House Section 12, this is the same language that makes a technical change to the State Dislocated Worker Program. Is Ms. Doyle Fontaine returned yet?
She has not.
I will continue reading the Senate sections as well then. Page R22, Senate Section 10. This is a Senate-only provision that requires grant recipient nonprofit organizations to report information regarding revenue, expenses, and compensation to DEED. Turning to page R23, Senate Section 11, House Section 13, this is similar language that makes a technical modification to the definition of credential for the purposes of the Uniform Outcome Report Cards. The House makes additional minor change. Page R23, Senate Section 12, House Section 14. This is different language on the same subject, making changes to the Uniform Outcome Report Cards. The Senate requires a list of any grant recipients who did not satisfy all reporting requirements, whereas the House removes requirements to report information about the cost of programs. Turning to page R25, Senate Section 13 is Senate-only language that modifies requirements for notice provided to employees at the beginning of employment. Turning to page R27, Senate Section 14. This is Senate-only language that caps the penalty amount at 20 days for unpaid wages and unpaid commissions. Turning to page R28, Senate Section 15. This is Senate-only language that requires an annual report from DEED to the legislature regarding unemployment insurance overpayments. Turning to page R29, Senate Section 16 through 20. This is Senate-only language that extends dates and makes technical changes to the forgivable loan program for remote recreational businesses. Turning to page R30, House Senate Section 15. This is House-only language that establishes the Canadian Border Counties Economic Relief Program to make grants to businesses adversely affected by the closures of the Canadian border and the BWCA since 2020. Turning to page R31, House Section 16. This is House-only language that creates the Small Business Recovery Grant Program to make grants through a lottery to small businesses impacted by the pandemic and other economic challenges. Turning to page R34, House Section 17. This is House-only language that allows grant recipients of the Minnesota Investment Fund, Job Creation Fund, and Border-to-Border Broadband Programs to incur eligible expenses for up to 90 days prior to an encumbrance being established in the accounting system. Finally, on page R34, House Section 18, this is House-only language that makes the provisions of Chapter 16A that apply to general fund appropriations for capital projects no longer apply to projects under the Targeted Community Capital Project Grant Program. And that completes the side-by-side for economic development. And to Ms. Marta James, to present the dissimilar policy articles in the labor and workforce development areas.
Before we get to that, Ms. Doyle-Fontaine, Ms. Shaleen, I think, covered the Senate provisions. Anything you'd want to add before we move on?
Not that I know of, Mr. Chair, but I will pipe in if there's something I
Great.
Realize.
Okay, Ms. James.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. My name is Martha James from House Research, and I am going to go over the dissimilar policy articles. Each of these articles is a separate document, and so I will just go over them one by one very briefly. So starting with House Articles 3 and 4, this are House-only provisions, and they create the paid family and medical leave benefits program. Article 6 is a Senate-only provision, and Ms. Doyle-Fontaine was going to address that.
Mr. Chair, and members, I was just going to say that Article 6 was the frontline worker Senate version of the bill, which is Chapter 50, so you've already done that work.
Thank you.
Thank you. Then turning to House Article 5, this would make a certain hourly school employees eligible for unemployment benefits between school terms. House Article 8 is another House-only article, conforms minimum penalties to federal law, and ties future fine increases to inflation. House-only Article 9 modifies and adds to existing laws addressing labor standards for agricultural and food processing workers. Then House-only Article 10, that would make technical changes to competitive sports licensing. Turning then to House-only Article 11, this article modifies the PERB effective date and treatment of data. House-only Article 12 requires at least a certain percent of employees of contractors at oil refineries to have registered apprenticeship experience. Article 13, another House-only provision, would create an ombudsperson and committee at the Department of Labor and Industry to address agricultural and food processing worker wellness. Articles 14 and 15 are also House-only, and these are the earned sick and safe time requirements and enforcement provisions. And finally, Article 16, House-only, establishes safety requirements for warehouse distribution workers. And that's all of the articles. Happy to answer any questions.
Thank you, Ms. Shaleen. Any questions from committee members? Okay. Seeing none, we have about 10 minutes left.
I don't think we were planning on going through the commerce provisions unless we could do it very quickly, but it, there's not a matching bill. So I think that concludes our agenda for today, unless there's any questions, any comments. Representative Knorr, did you want to talk about our next meeting?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. As you can see, the House has been busy putting together very great bills, so I think we will start with the Commerce on Monday to finalize that section, and then we will allow the commissioners to testify, and we'll also allow some of the provisions that we wanted to allow some individuals to come and testify. We'll send the agenda so we can discuss what will be ahead. So that will be the agenda for Monday. So just wanted to let everybody know we're coming back here on Monday at 1 p.m.
Okay. With that, members, we stand adjourned until Monday, 1 p.m.